Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm James Wickham, and on this edition...
I kind of like President Trump. He just seems to be capable and competent.
I'm voting for Kamala because she represents everything that I stand for.
America decides and the global economy waits the decision with bated breath. The Spanish Prime Minister pledges billions to the reconstruction effort following the flooding which killed more than 200 people. And Nintendo struggles as gamers await its new console. All of that's come. But even though this is a special podcast-only edition of the programme, you can always message us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. Here's the number, 0044 330 678 3033. That's 0044 330 678 3033. Or you can email us at any time on world.business@bbc.co.uk. I promise we do read them all. Now, this is a numbers programme, and of course, there's an important number we all need to be aware of in the next few hours and days. 270. That's how many Electoral College votes are needed to take the presidency for either the current Vice President, Kamala Harris, or the former President, Donald Trump. The opinion polls, well, they're deadlocked, despite billions being spent on advertising. Of course, reaction to the vote here on the BBC World Service throughout the next 24 hours and well beyond that, no doubt. But let's start here on this edition with our North America business correspondent, Ritika Gupta, and George Conboy, who's a regular on our programmes. He's the chairman of Brighton Securities and is based in Rochester, New York. Ritika, let me come to you first. What have we heard from the candidates today?
Well, both candidates are making their final push on election day, telling everyone to go out and vote. Vice President Kamala Harris, she's trying to win over the black voters. That's a demographic whose support she's been lacking as per the polls. She did a blitz interview with Atlanta radio station saying her focus for black men ranges from access to capital to what they need to do for healthcare. Yesterday, she was campaigning in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, a crucial swing state. Harris, she's registered to vote in California. She said she cast her ballot by mail, and she'll be planning to watch the watch party today at Washington's Howard University in D.C. Now, Trump, he spoke to the press after casting his ballot in Florida today. He said he's very confident that he'll win the election and that it won't even be close, in his words. Trump didn't say how he voted on a ballot referendum to expand abortion access, but he did address concerns of civil unrest once the results are known. Trump said that there would be no violence from his supporters. And he said he'll concede if he believes it's a fair election.
Now, what are both of these candidates promising economically? We are an economics programme, after all. Let's talk about the money.
And voters have identified the economy as one of the most, or if not the most, pressing issue in this election. Both candidates are looking to tackle inflation and the cost of living. Kamala Harris has said that her day one priority would be trying to reduce food and housing costs for working families. She wants price controls on groceries. She wants to help first-time homebuyers and raise the minimum wage. Trump has promised to, quote, end inflation and make America affordable again. And when asked how he would do this, he said that more drilling for oil will lower energy costs. And he's also promised to impose higher tax on imports that economists have warned could actually push up prices. In truth, economists have warned that both candidates would increase the deficit. That's an area that isn't really being addressed by either candidate. Now, for the business and stock markets, it's the corporate taxes that will be in focus. And they have polar opposite tax proposals. Kamala Harris wants to raise the corporate tax rate to 28% from 21%. Trump wants to lower it to 15% for companies that make their products here in the US. And these tax policies matter to businesses and the stock market because, well, tax rates impacts profits. But the question is how much and what impact that would have on the broader stock market.
Yeah. And look, I mentioned that 270 number to start off with. That's the Electoral College, and that's the number of votes they need in it to become president. So how does this system work? What are we looking for over the next few hours?
Well, I think the key thing to remember is that the winner is not necessarily the person who gets the most votes across the country. Instead, both candidates are competing to win contests across the 50 states. Now, each state has a certain number of what we call electoral college votes, which are partly based on population. There are a total of 538 that are up for grabs. And the winner, as you mentioned, is the candidate that wins 270. And most states, we see them leaning heavily towards one party or the other. So the focus tends to be on the key swing states, seven of those that are very much in focus that could really tip the scales. And again, it is possible for a candidate to win the most votes nationally, like Hillary Clinton did back in 2016, but still be defeated by the Electoral College.
And am I right in saying, Ritika, that if I were to ask you the question, when do we get a result, you'd be fair enough to say, I don't know, and neither does anybody else?
Yes, I think that is just the big uncertainty here. Over 80 million people have voted so far. And in 2020, we had to wait till Saturday to call the election with the vote on Tuesday. And there are fears that this could follow in that direction and take days. But there is some cautious optimism that it could be quicker this time round. In Georgia, one of the key swing states, they changed how they report the votes to make it potentially quicker this time. All the early votes that have been cast must be released, their results by 8 p.m. tonight. So that's a big portion that would be released earlier. But because it's so neck and neck and a knife edge race in many states, that could mean that many media outlets, they wait longer before projecting who's won. And narrow victories could also mean recounts.
Yeah.
So it's just very uncertain.
Yeah, absolutely. Ritika, thank you very much. And we should say as well, it's not just the presidency today. There's also this decision about who will control Congress. That's as important as well. But George, let me come to you. Has there been any market reaction so far?
Well, there has, James. We're up about a 1% on the Dow Jones. Standard & Poor's up 1.25%. NASDAQ up 1.4%. General good trade across the board today after a very uneven start. Afternoon was good.
Yeah. What are markets looking for then from this election and in a president as well? I would assume the main thing, and the thing I always am told here, is a bit of solidity, consistency, and no surprises.
Yes, the enemy of investors is uncertainty. People don't like uncertainty. Investors don't want uncertainty. And while a presidential election, even with a result, doesn't give you certainty of economic policy, the fact is, something overlooked here is, regardless of who wins the election, in a few months, we will have a president. Unspoken is that right now, no one really knows whose hand is on the tiller of the ship of state. We don't have a really actively functioning president in many people's minds. So whether we get one or the other, will at least have someone in charge. And I think markets see that as a plus.
And tonight, George, I mean, it's a very big night. Lots of people will be staying up. Is that your plan for the evening?
I never stay up too late, James. If they don't give me a pretty good result in the media by 10:30 or 11, I'll go to sleep, because I've got a theory about elections.
Go on.
Especially close elections like this. That theory is the cow and chicken theory. Now, tomorrow morning, no matter who wins, the farmer will go in the barn. The cow is going to give milk, and the chicken is going to lay an egg. And tomorrow, no matter who's the new president, that will happen, and the world will keep turning.
Do you know, I wasn't expecting this to turn to cows and chickens, but I liked it very much. Thank you very much indeed. George Conboy is the chairman of Brighton Securities, based in Rochester, New York. Thank you, George. Thank you also to Ritika Gupta, our North America business correspondent. And of course, we should say there will be results here from 2200 GMT on the BBC World Service, which might be just as this podcast drops into your feed. We're going to have full market reaction too with Will Bain on the 1530 GMT edition of the programme on Wednesday. This is World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, James Wickham. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has announced an $11 billion aid and reconstruction package for areas affected by devastating flash floods. Mr. Sanchez said 15,000 military personnel and police had now been deployed. The central and regional governments have been facing fierce criticism over their response to the floods, which killed at least 217 people. Now, Mr. Sanchez has announced that everyone affected will be able to claim tens of thousands of dollars in assistance for repairing damaged homes and belongings. More than $900 million has been set aside for small and medium-sized businesses and the self-employed. But he also said the government recognised that no amount of support could make up for what had happened.
We know in any case from the government of Spain that this is not enough. that there are still missing people who need to be found, destroyed homes and businesses buried under the mud, and many people who are suffering severe shortages. And that is why we have to continue working without distractions, with more resources, with more coordination, and with greater effort until normality has returned to all the municipalities and to all the homes hit by this tragedy. This is the commitment of the government of Spain.
Well, of course, for many, the immediate problem is still dealing with the situation at hand. Juan Bordera is an opposition MP in the Valencia region.
We're trying to recover normality. We have flooded areas from Almeria in the south of Spain to Barcelona, almost near France. So we have a very critical situation here in the Mediterranean. People are very angry.
Our Madrid correspondent is Guy Hedgeco, and I asked Guy first what the latest forecast was for the area.
The weather is better than it was, certainly, over the last few days. The weather event, this so-called Dana, has now ended, both in the Valencia region, where it caused the most damage, and also in the northeast in Catalonia. But Catalonia, for example, has seen some extremely heavy rain in the last day or two. Valencia has seen some rainfall, but it's not the kind of rainfall that the region was seeing over the last few days. And the hope is that any rainfall that comes in the next few days will be manageable and won't be on the same scale that we have seen, that we saw a week ago.
Now, you've written a great piece on BBC.com all about the political reaction to what has happened in the last week or so. It's well worth a read. This package today, which was announced by the Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, follows days and days of criticism, doesn't it, over what's seen as inaction by the government?
Yes, that's right. There's been a lot of criticism of the regional government of Valencia for failing to respond quickly enough to the floods when they first started last week, and also criticism of the central government, people saying that there just simply hasn't been enough support for people affected by the flooding in Valencia, and it hasn't come quick enough. And that's been the really big criticism, that, for example, emergency services and the military have been deployed to the area. In many cases, they haven't been seen there, at least until the end of last week, in many cases. So this comes after that, and I think it's certainly an attempt by the central government to try and fend off that kind of criticism and show that it is capable of managing a tragedy like this and finding a response to it that will improve the lives of people after they were so devastated, whether it's housing, infrastructure, or businesses, or self-employed workers.
Is there any sense that this money that's been promised is enough? Because there was another suggestion, a proposal, wasn't there, by the regional government yesterday, and the two numbers aren't the same?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the regional government of Valencia, which has kind of been clashing with the central government in the last day or two, sort of over whose fault the poor response to this has been, the regional government proposed an aid package of 31 billion euros. That's three times, more or less, what Pedro Sanchez has announced just now. But what the regional government was proposing was a much bigger package of aid. And that is similar to the entire budget of the Valencia region for a year. So what was being proposed there is a huge amount of money. But it's quite possible that this first aid package being announced by the government is extended and increases. And that the indication that we got from Pedro Sanchez is that there could be more money than this that comes eventually, because this may not cover the needs of the people of Valencia.
Mm. Now, southern Spain is an area I know very well, full disclosure. I travel there a lot. It is a very big agricultural area as well. You know, this is going to be devastating for those farmers in that area. And potentially there's going to be a knock on here, isn't there, Guy, to Europe's vegetable and fruit stocks as well?
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's of southeastern corner of Spain in particular, produces a tremendous amount of fruit and vegetables. And that's an area which has been affected to a certain extent by these floods. And it's an area which is known here in Spain as the Garden of Europe, because it produces so much produce, which is sent out and exported to countries like the UK and other countries across Europe. Now, a year or two back, there was a serious drought in Spain, and it was a drought that affected that specific area. And because of that drought, there were concerns that would have a knock-on effect in terms of the price of fruit and vegetables in supermarkets. Now, that in the end, that impact was limited, but you can see how things like the weather, climate-related elements can have a direct impact, not just on the agriculture, but then that food which is exported elsewhere, and that could have an effect on prices in supermarkets eventually.
That's our Madrid correspondent Guy Hedgeco there. Thank you very much to him. And from Spain, we move to France, where there's a couple of very interesting stories. Our reporter Barbara George is with me. Barbara, a busy day for the French authorities and football.
So searches have been taking place at the headquarters of the French Football League and at the home of its president. This is after allegations of corruption in a deal over media transmission rights. The premises of private equity firm CVC Capital Partners, which signed the contract with the Football League 2 years ago, were also searched.
Yeah, and this is the latest bit, isn't it, of a really long-running saga?
Yeah, so it's involving the French League, the clubs and the broadcasters. The League signed a contract with the equity firm CVC after the collapse of a previous broadcasting deal. Under that deal, CVC gets 13% of all future income from match transmissions in return for a payment of 1.5 billion euros. The contract has been widely attacked, including by the French Senate, and now investigators are looking into the conditions under which it was sealed, specifically into a 37 million euro bonus that was supposed to be shared out on completion between banks, lawyers and the league's bosses.
Really interesting story. We should say CVC and the French League haven't yet commented, but we will keep following that story here on World Business Report. Now, we should say there's also problems for Netflix as well.
Yeah, so it's involving offices in Paris and Amsterdam. They've been raided by the French and Dutch authorities as part of an investigation into tax fraud. Officials from the two countries have been cooperating on the case since the investigation was opened in November 2022.
So have we heard yet from Netflix?
So Netflix have not yet made any specific comments on the raids, but it insists it complies with tax laws wherever it operates. The Amsterdam office is the headquarters of the company's operation in Europe, the Middle East and Africa. The French investigation is being carried out by the National Financial Prosecutor's Office, a special unit used for investigations into high-profile white-collar crime. It says the raid relates to suspicions of covering up serious tax fraud and off-the-books work. The company is also under investigation for tax filings for 2019, 2020 and 2021.
Barbara, thanks very much indeed. Now let's switch to the Switch, as it were, which isn't doing as well as Nintendo was hoping for. The Japanese video games company says its profits dropped 60% in the first half of its financial year to $710 million. Now that's largely because of sales of its Switch console plunging as people wait for an updated version. Alana Hakes is deputy editor at Nintendo Life, and she joined me from the US.
The Switch 2 rumours that have been going on for a long time, I'd say at least since year 3 or 4 of the Switch. Right now, it feels like they've reached a fever pitch with the amount of just leaks, potential rumours floating around. And people have been going, oh, the Switch 2 will be announced this month. But Nintendo has teased it. I think they said in their last financial report that they would announce it during this fiscal year, so the 2024-2025 fiscal year. We're halfway through now, and that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I mean, has Nintendo made a bit of a mess of the timing of this, do you think? Because usually you'd expect them to be released in time for the festive season.
You would, yes. And I think, well, the Nintendo Switch is probably the most successful console. It is the most successful console other than the Game Boy that they've ever released. So I think they've been hedging their bets on it selling even more. Like right now, it's like approaching PlayStation 2's lifetime sales, which is pretty significant. So I think they're holding on to that. I think a number of factors have played into it. There was a semiconductor shortage last year, which has slowed down development and production. And I think, honestly, they are holding out for next year. But I have to agree in some way that teasing the release or teasing an announcement has got people excited and speculative, and everyone expected it to be out at the end of this year, whereas yeah, that hasn't happened. And it's now looking like 2025 holiday season.
Now, just give us an idea. I mean, you've kind of mentioned it, but give us an idea on where the Switch sits in the console wars, because we've got the Xbox. You mentioned we've got the PlayStation as well. We've got the Switch. How's it doing in comparison to those? And is it a different audience that the Switch is going for?
I think the Nintendo Switch probably has the broadest audience in terms of appeal. You've got a bigger, wider variety of games that appeal to various different age demographics. Whereas I think Xbox is in maybe a very even more precarious situation with the drop in sales for the Xbox and also their multi-platform strategy, which they announce exclusives and then like a few months later, those exclusives are no longer exclusive. Whereas Nintendo feels very unique in that of the big three, it's really the only one that has any big exclusive. You know, everyone knows Mario and Zelda and Kirby and everything else and Animal Crossing. Whereas nowadays, I think you struggle to associate a lot of those brands with Microsoft and Sony as much. In terms of console wars, I mean, in recent years, obviously, the PlayStation 5 is selling slightly better. Really, it's a newer console. It's more powerful. It has got those big name games on there, like you've got your Last of Us and your Horizons. But the Switch is in its eighth year. And, you know, the install base at this point is basically settled.
Yeah.
So I think that's just kind of not stagnating, but it's like settled down, I think.
And yet, you know, as you say, it's 8 years old, but it's a risk, isn't it? Whenever you release a new console for Nintendo, it's a huge moment and a risky moment because if it doesn't go as well as they hope, they've got big problems.
Yeah, and we've seen that with the Wii U. The Wii was an absolutely gigantic success. And then the Wii U came out and that was a huge flop and everyone was really surprised. And there was real concern coming from the Nintendo camp, essentially. And the Switch is like the complete opposite. So it's like they've had real peaks and troughs throughout the years, even like the Nintendo 64 underperformed compared to the PlayStation 1. The GameCube as well was an underperformer. Nintendo have always had a very strong hold on the handheld market. And I think that's why the Switch has done as well as it has, because it is that hybrid console. You can have it on the TV and carry it on the go and play it on the go as well. But yeah, whatever they do with the Switch 2, it's going to be a real risk, because do they play it safe and do something really similar to the Switch, or do they essentially go completely left wing and do something completely ridiculous, like give it a new gimmick or something like that? Yeah, every console's had its own unique selling point, and with the Switch 2 or whatever it's going to be called, we don't really know whether it's going to be another Switch or whether they're just going to do something completely different.
That's Alana Hagues from Nintendo Life. Now, the Danish town of Kalundborg should be booming like few others. It's the home of the main manufacturing plant of the weight loss drug Wegovy. That's made the pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk billions of dollars and the most highly valued firm in Europe. Well, to meet the spiralling demand for its products, it's trying to attract thousands of professional workers from around the world to live in Kalundborg. The mayor is hoping a cosmopolitan workforce will transform the town. But first, he's got to persuade them to move there. Bob Howard takes up the story.
Kalundborg is home to just 16,000 people, but also one of Europe's biggest building sites, the size of around 236 football pitches.
My name is Martin Dam. I'm the mayor of the municipality of Kalundborg. More than $9 billion is an ongoing investment right now. We have more than 1,000 new jobs every year added to the area.
Well, that's great news for the town's economy. At the moment, most of the people building the plant and many existing workers arrive by car from outside each morning and leave again in the afternoon. Locals call the resulting congestion the Novo Queue. When it comes to attracting workers as permanent residents, the mayor may have his work cut out. For families, attainment in Danish language and maths in state schools in the town is below the national average. And some of the schools on the periphery of the town are in desperate need of investment with poor facilities, says Helle Lawson Pettersen, a regional councillor.
If you saw that, you will take one of the other cities around here and say, well, we will live there and then I can drive to Kalundborg to work.
Perhaps the biggest irony in the Wegovy boomtown is how many children are overweight. In fact, Kalundborg is in the highest 5% of Danish towns. When it comes to local traders, there's a split. Supermarkets and takeaways are doing well, clothes and shoe shops less well. Some businesses just can't compete with Novo Nordisk for staff, says Brian Sonder Andersen, who runs the local cinema and is also the head of the local traders association.
There's just now one mechanic here in the city. He announced that he's going to close it here at the new year. He don't want to do it anymore. He's 3 mechanics behind every day. He needs 3 mechanics, and I can't get any because they all go out to work at Novo Nordisk.
A lot of the workers currently in the town are unlikely to stay long and so probably won't get into the habit of using some local stores. Tanuj is from India and is helping build the new plant. He's playing cricket in his spare time and says without the national sport, he'd be at a bit of a loss for what to do.
Yeah, what else we could have done? Maybe a little bit of beer or go outside the beach area, sit alone. So we thought of starting a cricket game over here. Every weekend we are playing.
Still, some people are taking the plunge. Miguel Oliveira is Brazilian and recently moved to the town with his wife Amanda and their 2 children to work as a health and safety advisor.
Our plan now is stay for long term. At least have the kids in the university. So when they are in the university, I think our mission is accomplished. So we provided the proper education to them and they can take the decision about their life after that. Even if Denmark is an older country than Brazil, we realize here a lot of opportunities.
The mayor hopes things like offering university courses in biotech may attract undergraduates who then want to stay on, along with families like Miguel and Amanda.
We are doing a lot of effort to attract people because we need a skilled workforce. There's not enough skilled people in Denmark, so we have to attract people from abroad.
A new highway into Kalundborg is being built to help ease the morning and afternoon congestion. The question is whether that attracts more people to live in the town or means they can get home more quickly at the end of their working day.
That's Bob Howard. You can hear more from him on assignment. But that's it from this edition of World Business Report.